From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
To anyone who intends to come take away the freedom and opportunity and dignity of Illinoisans, I would remind you that a happy warrior is still a warrior. You come for my people, you come through me.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker. Some tough talk after Donald Trump won the presidency again. Illinois Democrats are looking at ways to combat the former president and some of his policies as he gets ready to take office. We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Alex Degman. He covers the State House for WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio stations. Alex, good to have you back on with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Alex, the fall veto session, I kind of hesitate to call it that. There were no vetoes this year to deal with, but it has started. We've got another week to go of that. There's not a lot going on, I guess, right now, but it sounds like there's a lot happening maybe behind the scenes. Democrats are considering possible actions that could be taken to prepare for Donald Trump version 2.0. What are they looking to do? What are some of the concerns that they have right now?
Yeah, I guess this year we'll call it a fall legislative session and not a veto session.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, the Democrats that control the Illinois legislature are trying to figure out if there are any ways that they can shore up some of the protections that have already been enacted in the state. Now, you'll hear Governor Pritzker and you'll hear Democrats talk a lot about what has already been done. You know, they shored up reproductive rights. They shored up workers' rights through a constitutional amendment. And they're looking through, you know, documents like Project 2025. They're looking through Agenda 47 right now to see if there are any, I guess, holes in the armor, so to speak. I don't know if that's the expression to use, but, you know, that's what they're doing. Now, the caveat to that is that some of this, even though there is a sense of urgency, there is also kind of a wait and see sense because President Trump has not been sworn in yet. We don't know exactly what is going to happen when Trump takes office. We have some ideas. You know, he has said things like we need to go into mass deportations on day one and things like that. But some of the Democrats that I'm talking to are kind of, they hear that, but they also are putting forth a sense of caution because Donald Trump says a lot of things. And some of the times, some of the things he says don't come to fruition. So they want to make sure that they are going to get it right, so to speak. So it's a lot of a wait and see, but there's also some things that they are considering. For example, Kelly Cassidy has had an idea for a while about perhaps protecting people who come to Illinois for reproductive care or for gender affirming care, for example. They don't want other state governments to be able to use geolocation tracking like Google Maps or Apple Maps to be able to track people as they come into Illinois. So it's things like that. But then there's also the problem of, well, federal law a lot of times supersedes state law if the state law is not as strict as the federal law. So when it comes to certain things, like Democrats are talking a lot about what happens if the National Guard is federalized to try to undergo this mass deportation plan, there's not a whole lot that state governments, that the legislature can do to legislate to prevent that. It's a pretty interesting time at the Capitol as they are trying to do a lot of things to prepare, but there's not a whole lot that they know specifically about what to prepare for.
It's not likely that we're going to see much action apparently this month, but we could see it early next year, possibly even before the new legislative session or new General Assembly is sworn in. Is that the way things are being heard right now?
Yeah, I think so. And this was only the first week of the veto session. There's still a week left. And then, yeah, there is a so-called lame duck session in January where the vote threshold drops back down to a simple majority. Even if there isn't this specific type of legislation that they're going to be considering, there's plenty of other stuff that they could be taking up. Like, for example, Karina's bill, the medical aid in dying bill. Those are still things that were from the 103rd General Assembly that haven't been addressed yet. So there's still plenty to do, and I'm sure that we'll see plenty of it in the lame duck session.
Yeah, Charlie, it's getting into into the weeds a little bit when we talk about the different types of sessions. But as Alex mentioned, it can be easier at times to pass something in what's known as a lame duck session right before the new General Assembly is sworn in. And we've seen that happen through the years, some very controversial measures. This time, I don't know if it's so much controversial from a General Assembly standpoint. Most of the Democrats have a super majorities in both chambers, but it seems as though as we inch closer, as they hear more from Donald Trump, that they may have a better idea, you know, a roadmap of what they're looking to do.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And one of the things to recall is, as Alex pointed out, there are still issues pending from the General Assembly that is going to go out of existence in January that are pretty far along the legislative track and have cleared a lot of the procedural hurdles already, but haven't had a final vote. And you can do that in the lame duck session, whereas if you wait a couple weeks when the new General Assembly starts, you have to have bill introductions, readings on three separate days in each chamber, go to committee, go to votes, and the likelihood of getting anything passed quickly is pretty slim once the new General Assembly gets sworn in. Whereas the issues that are still pending or still hanging from the last couple of years can be addressed really in the space of a day if the legislature has the will to do it. So I think that's what they're looking at. And it's interesting because one of the things that happened, the incoming president has said he's going to deport everybody who's not here legally, who's not a U.S. citizen. They're out the door. The Chicago Board of Education earlier this week passed a resolution unanimously saying that they basically will not cooperate with the attempts to expel undocumented children. And they said it would oppose any legislation that creates a Muslim registry system or erodes civil rights. The district, and this is a quote from the resolution, will not provide assistance to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the enforcement of federal civil immigration law. ICE will not be allowed to enter or interact with district facilities or staff unless it provides Chicago Public Schools with a criminal warrant. The particular story in Chalkby pointed out that Chicago has been a sanctuary city since 1985, long before Donald Trump was involved in politics. Mayor Harold Washington signed an executive order then declaring protections for immigrants, and it became law in 2006. So this is longstanding practice in Chicago. The Chicago Public Schools has thousands of migrant students enrolled now. Its share of students learning English as a new language increased by more than 12% this school year, largely due to immigration. So that's an indication of what can happen at a local level. But I think the legislature is going to be in a wait and see and try and figure out what can we do in areas. One of the things that we're going to take hit on is Trump is going to get rid of the subsidies for electric vehicles. You might say to yourself, well, wait, isn't Elon Musk, Tesla's guy, isn't he a big fan of Trump's? Isn't he one of Trump's bosom buddies? And Musk said, yeah, Tesla might be hurt a little bit, but it's really going to screw GM and the other people trying to get into the market. So that would be a blow to us and to our goal to try and reach a carbon-free future within what I think the goal is by 2050. So there's going to be those kinds of things, economic development things where there will be cutbacks. And so there'll be, I guess you would call them business-related changes that are going to be harmful to Illinois over and above the so-called the social justice issues.
I've talked to some people who voted for Donald Trump, supported him very strongly, and some of them have really believed that some of the things that Donald Trump said on the campaign trail are not going to wind up happening. They're almost skeptical of that. They think that that was just talk. But, you know, I look at, and Alex, there, a lot has changed since Donald Trump's first presidency. He has a Congress that's more likely, I think, to go along with him and some of his priorities. Had a Supreme Court ruling, pretty much gives him carte blanche when it comes to his actions, whether or not he could be held criminally accountable. And we've had the Dobbs decision, of course, and abortion. So Democrats, advocates for some of these organizations or individuals out there, it seems to me they would have reason to be worried, at least from what he said before. We don't know what he's going to do, but they, you know, can only take him at his word right now. And that seems like I think it's probably caused some real concern among those groups.
Yeah, and you're seeing that play out depending on who you're talking to. And it's not, I mean, it's just, it's pretty much across the board in Illinois because they know that Illinois is, as you mentioned, well, I think Charlie mentioned Chicago specifically has been a sanctuary city since the 80s. And that's kind of the view of Chicago and Illinois that national Republicans, at least national Republicans that follow Donald Trump, have. So people in Illinois, they are worried about what is going to happen. And that's why you're seeing a lot of these discussions starting to happen about, you know, how do we protect our states? How do we protect our cities? Even if we don't know exactly what's going to happen, and even if we don't know if everything that Donald Trump says is going to happen, you know, there still is rightfully a cause for concern.
Well, also this week, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced that he's co-founding a coalition of governors that will be pushing back against Trump, Democratic governors. Alex, this struck me. I want to take the governor at his word. I know he doesn't agree with Donald Trump on things, and that's a lot of the impetus behind this. It's also a political move, and you have to look at it that way as well, because it puts J.B. Pritzker and maybe a few others front and center in the fight against Donald Trump, and that could dictate who runs for president the next time for the Democratic Party. So, it was a interesting announcement. Didn't take him long after Trump was elected to get out in front of this. So your thoughts on this, though?
Yeah, I think it seems like it's kind of just like what you said. It is trying to get J.B. Pritzker front and center in the pushback against a Donald Trump presidency. The group that was formed is called Governor Safeguarding Democracy. It's GSD for short. Supposedly, it's a bipartisan group. GOP lawmakers are, when the call was happening that was announcing the group, we were asking about if there are any Republicans on it. Wouldn't say. There were some governors that don't want their names publicly associated with it. I'm guessing that could mean because that they are in states that might be affected by this. But for Pritzker's sake, this is a really good way for him to stay in the spotlight. And it's not as though the group is going to be pushing any specific, I don't think they're going to be pushing any specific strategy or any specific legislation state by state. But this is just a show of force, I guess. I think the quote from Pritzker said, what we're doing is pushing back against increasing threats of autocracy and fortifying the institutions of democracy. Like, they're trying to paint incoming president-elect Donald Trump as this existential threat that these people and only these people can stand in the way of.
Charlie, your thoughts on this move by the governor as well?
Well, I think it's a good thing from a public policy point of view to try and organize other governors who might be concerned about the federal government suddenly changing direction and imposing requirements on the states or doing things to people in the states that the governors don't agree with. And so as a public policy position, I think it's good for the chief executives of the states to work together to advance common goals. And as a political move, yeah, it's a way for Governor Pritzker to put his name out there as being a national leader and to have some degree of public notice as a potential Democratic presidential candidate in 4 years. And as a matter of fact, the governor has been very active in reproductive rights. If I'm not mistaken, he formed a group called Think Big America last year to support ballot abortion rights ballot initiatives across the state. And I think they won in like 7 states where voters approved amendments to their constitutions or other referenda to safeguard reproductive rights. So he's got a national image already. And so this can help him in that respect. And as I say, I think it's a good idea for the governors to work together to try and figure out what they need to do to be able to combat what they see coming from Washington that is going to be harmful to their citizens.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and WBEZ's Alex Degman. Well, Alex, this week, public employee unions made some noise. They've been doing this for a while, about a pension system called Tier 2. If you're not in Springfield or work in state government in some way, you may not know what this is. It was put in place several years ago and provides a little bit lesser benefits to those who started at that time and later. But they say there are problems with this, and they're wanting the state to make some changes to it. What are they seeking? Why is this such an issue right now?
Well, I'll tell you what, this week, it kind of reminded me of the so-called old days. My old days at the Capitol are like 2009 and 2010, when public employee unions were flooding the Capitol a lot, demanding pension changes and like basically demanding not to be cut out of the budget. This kind of had the same kind of vibe, because the people who were flooding the Capitol are upset that basically they've been paying into a system, they've been paying as much into a pension system as the tier one employees are, but they are getting far worse benefits. And in fact, recent analysis has come to bear that the benefits offered by tier two pensions for state employees don't meet Social Security's safe harbor requirements. And that basically says that if you are going to have a pension plan that is going to preclude your employees from paying into Social Security over the course of their career, the benefits that they get have to at least be as good as Social Security. And in tier two, that's not the case. And part of the reason for that is, I think everybody knew in 2011 that the benefits in tier two were not going to be as good, because that was the whole point of creating a new set of benefits, was to save money. The state's pension obligations at the time were just ballooning out of control. And in a lot of ways, they still are. They're getting better, but there's still a lot of unfunded liabilities. So everybody knew that the benefits weren't going to be as good, but I don't think everybody necessarily knew what the effects would be of, for example, using the final 8 years of salary instead of the final 4 years of salary to calculate your final pensionable salary. You know, things like that, that just really, and not to mention the retirement age being increased to 67. That's also a pretty big point of consternation. So there are a lot of changes, but they're not easy fixes. That's the big problem here, because pensions are expensive. And part of the reason that Illinois implemented Tier 2 was to save money. And now there was an analysis in the Chicago Tribune, I think, that was, I want to say like the middle of April this came out, where if there were enough fixes to Tier 2 to fix the problems that are befalling it, it would cost well over $5 billion over the next 20 years. And when you have a state government that's about to enter into another time of, I'm not going to call it fiscal austerity, but, you know, we're certainly seeing budget numbers for the future, for future years, that aren't as rosy as they have been. So this is going to be a challenge. This is going to be something I don't know if they're going to be able to address during veto, because it's a massive bill. It's almost 700 pages. But this is a pretty, as you said at the start, Sean, this has been a pretty big issue for unions for a while, and they're starting to make a lot of noise about it.
I should mention that both Charlie and I are members of the State University Retirement System. Charlie is a retiree. Both of us, though, came in under Tier 1, so that's not the issue here for us. But Charlie, do these people have a point when it comes to especially that Social Security angle? I think that's the part that I don't know that everybody understands. So do they have a point bringing this up and wanting these changes for the Tier 2 employees?
Yeah, I think they do have a very solid point. And you can look at it from two ways. One way to look at it is equity. Someone who would have been hired after Tier 2 came into effect in 2011 would have to work longer and get fewer benefits than someone like Sean or myself who are in Tier 1. And I'm retired and I'm getting those benefits now. And Sean, at some point, will retire and receive those benefits. And so that it's really unfair. And there's a practical matter involved here too. One of the people who's introduced one of these legislations is Representative Stephanie Kifowit. And she pointed out that one of the problems is that the reduced benefits under Tier 2 make it harder to recruit and hire people. And her quote says, "What we heard a lot in committee is that employees are leaving, and sometimes leaving the teaching profession, because young teachers don't want to have to work until they're 67 to qualify for a full pension. And we are losing people because of that." And so the state is having a hard time, and school districts are having a hard time hiring people because of this. The issue is one that goes back long before any of us were either even on Earth. It goes back more than 100 years, because from day one of the first institution of public employee pensions, retirement systems, the state has never put in enough every year to cover the benefits going to be paid in that year and enough money to cover the future benefits for people who are in the system. And that's gone on, as I say, forever. As a matter of fact, in 1994, the legislature and the governor put together an agreement that required a steady stream of payments over the next 50 years that would meet the constitutional obligation to the state employees. And at that time, in 1997, the pension system's unfunded liability was $13.7 billion. Well, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability's last report on the condition of the state's pension systems, this was last, I think December came out, said the unfunded liability is now $140 billion. So it's increased more than 10 times in the space of, what, 25 years, even though we're putting more and more money into it. But yeah, and the problem is because they're not in Social Security, the state doesn't have to make Social Security payments on behalf of its employees, or school districts do not have to make Social Security payments. And instead, you can kick the pension can down the road, so to speak. Whereas if you're in Social Security, the Social Security Administration does not allow you to pile up the bills. You have to pay regularly. And so that's another incentive to try and make Tier 2 meet the bare minimums of what benefits would be available for these folks were they in Social Security.
Yeah, and Charlie, just real quick to wrap this up before we move on. This and what I've heard through the years is it could wind up going to court. Somebody could challenge this, and it goes to court. The state's going to be on the hook for it. So there's some thought about trying to get out ahead of it by the for the legislature and the governor. Is that the way you've understood it? It could wind up being a situation where the state is ordered by the courts to pay it.
Oh yeah, yeah, and this is a proactive move on their part. The largest government retirement fund is for the teachers, the teacher retirement system. And Tier 2 benefits there would begin to fall out of compliance by 2027, according to people who study this stuff, because the limit on benefits and inflation adjustments would be much tighter than Social Security. And that would result in us being out of whack with the Social Security. And yeah, they go to court. And there'd be no doubt but that the plaintiffs would win that case. And a judge could order the state, okay, you have to put $10 billion into the system tomorrow, which would really mess us up big time.
Okay. Just a few minutes left here. And Alex, there was also an announcement from the governor's office this week, something that was put into the state budget back in the spring. This was an initiative of the governor's office, had to do with medical debt. And they announced sort of how that's going. So give us an update on that.
Yeah, the governor said, the governor put into this year's state budget $10 million to buy up to $1 billion of past due medical debts, debt that can't be collected. And that seems like, it seemed like a really confusing thing at the start, but there are a lot of companies out there where you can buy debt that has just been outstanding for years for pennies on the dollar. And that's essentially what the state's doing. They're working with a company called Undue Medical Debt, and they just announced this week that so far they have erased about $72 million of medical debt for about 52,000 people. And most of that, about 20,000 of those people were concentrated in Will County in the Chicago area. But there were people who benefited in almost every county. This is the type of thing that you don't apply for. This is something that just happens automatically. And if you are selected, you're not going to know about it until you get a certified letter in the mail from the company, Undue Medical Debt, informing you that your debt's been erased. And what I found particularly interesting about this release is we don't know how much state money was spent to erase the $72 million. So I don't know how much is left in the overall $10 million budget. And maybe I missed that. I didn't see it in the release announcing this, but it's a pretty interesting thing. It's a pretty innovative way. I've never heard before of this, but before this initiative, I don't think I've ever heard of state governments using these buying debt for pennies on the dollar to take care of healthcare debt before.
Charlie, you thought this was a good idea when they put it in. You still feel that way about it?
Oh, yes, definitely so. As a matter of fact, the state's program is sort of modeled off something that happened in Cook County, where the county used $12 million from the American Rescue Plan, federal money, to forgive debt in partnership with the same nonprofit. And so far in Cook County, they've relieved $382 million of medical debt for 213,000 county residents.
All right. Well, let's go now to our notes from the field. And Alex, we'll go to you first.
Yeah, I think the thing that really caught my eye this week was having to go through security to get into the Capitol. it's typically, and I know that for people that don't work at the Capitol, that sounds kind of weird. But typically the way that it has worked is if you are credentialed and you get background checked through the Secretary of State and all that, you get a badge that allows you to bypass the security screening that guests and tourists have to go through, like people who don't work in the complex. But Secretary of State Alexi Janulis has handed down rules that say, well, if you have an orange badge, the badges are orange this year. If you have an orange badge, if you're a media or a lobbyist, you have to go through the line the same as everybody else, which kind of caught us by surprise because number one, they didn't tell us that this was happening. And number two, we immediately started thinking about how big of a pain this is going to be, especially on big lobby days like we saw on Wednesday with the Tier 2 pension rally. Hundreds and hundreds of people trying to get into the building at once, all going through maybe two or three entrances. If we're news reporters and we're covering something that's happening somewhere else in Springfield and we have to get back to the Capitol, guess what? We're going to miss our committee hearing because we have to stand in line with everybody else. So this may seem like an oh, woe is me problem, but you know, this could significantly hinder operations at the Capitol, especially if people are, if people who need to get from place to place quickly, like lobbyists and media, if they're being held up, it's going to slow things down.
And Charlie?
Well, Attorney General Kwame Raoul announced this week a statewide, what he calls a conviction integrity unit. And it's aimed at preventing wrongful convictions, and its job will be to investigate claims of actual innocence in violent felony cases where new and credible evidence of innocence has been discovered, or when new technology enables investigators to test or retest old evidence. And if the conviction integrity unit determines there's a probably actual innocence, it will work with the local state's attorney to determine if they should move forward and attempt to vacate the conviction. And they will also seek to identify the true perpetrator of the crime. And I might add as a footnote, Illinois has a horrible record in terms of wrongful convictions. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, almost 600 people have been exonerated for crimes in Illinois since 1989. And so these are folks who were imprisoned, who lost their jobs, maybe lost their families, lost years from their lives, and in many cases, particularly in the Chicago area, because of basically criminal behavior on the part of the authorities, particularly some of the Chicago Police Department investigators.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Alex Degman with WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.